What could be more dangerous to Jewish people right now than lumping us all in with this genocidal campaign of the Israeli government? We want a world where perpetrators of war crimes are held accountable. We want a world in which all people can live safely in their homes. That is both because of the lessons that we've taken from our own history and because of the world that we are fighting for today, that we want for all people, not just for Jews.
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today we sit down with Jewish American activist Simone Zimmerman. Zimmerman is the co-founder of If Not Now, a grassroots organization fighting to end the U.S. Jewish community's support for Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. Her experience challenging her beliefs about Israel and Zionism are documented in a powerful new film called Israelism.
I don't think I realized the extent to which what I would come to see on the ground would really shock me and horrify me. You are a self-loathing Jew. Go kill yourself.
An anti-Semitic Jew.
The way that we talk about anti-Semitism isn't about protecting Jews, it's about protecting Israel. How dangerous is that?
Since October 7 and the start of the war in Gaza, hundreds of rallies have been led by Jewish Americans protesting Israel's actions, some risking arrest or their careers, others being attacked and shunned by their own communities who question their very identity as Jews. Despite the intense criticism, many of these voices have only grown bolder, signaling what could be a generational shift in the way many young Jews see Israel and the way many young Americans see their government's relationship with it. Simone Zimmerman, welcome to The Big Picture. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you about this film, this great film, Israelism. I want to talk to you about your own journey, your own activism, and how everything is seen in the context of what's been happening over the last 6 months. But let's start with you. You are somebody who has become something of a public face for a generation of young Jewish Americans who are publicly questioning, critiquing Israel and Zionism. When you were a teenager, and you know, we talk about some of your experiences in the film, did you ever imagine that you'd be where you are today?
I mean, well, I was definitely raised to think that I would be a Jewish leader of some kind. You know, unfortunately for many of the people who gave me that message, they're probably not so happy with the type of leader I became. But
it's not quite how they imagined.
Yeah, but it's definitely, I'm jumping the gun here a little bit, but I think one of the jokes that we make, but it's actually quite serious in a lot of the Jewish left organizing that I'm part of, is that many of us have become people who have taken on the type of leadership, who are, you know, so devoted to our communities, who are working like tirelessly to build, you know, a Jewish life and a Jewish community that aligns with our values, which is actually exactly what so many of us were raised to want to do. But unfortunately for the old guard of our community, we're not doing it with the same political commitments or positions that they perhaps wanted us to take. And and that's one of the kind of great ironies of some of this work, because there's a lot of panic in the American Jewish community about assimilation, about young Jews staying involved and connected to the community. And some of the most effective work to keep young Jews engaged in Jewish life is actually left-wing anti-occupation, anti-apartheid organizing.
Tell me more about that, because I've heard you describe the work that you do and the way that you see it as a continuation of a lineage of a fight for justice. So how do you see that, and how do you see the way that you, you know, the role that you're playing right now fit into something that is much greater, much older?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, it's always important for me to say that even though we're in a moment of like tremendous revival and incredible, such a groundswell, right, of growth of support for the movement for ceasefire against Israeli apartheid within the Jewish community, these are, these are not new ideas. These are streams of thought and of activism that have always existed in Jewish communities. There have always been Jews who have dissented against Zionism. These debates have been very aggressively quashed and, you know, pushed out of the center of kind of like mainstream Jewish conversations, but they've always been there. There have always been Jewish people who have been, you know, attacked as traitors to the community for dissenting against this position over many, many decades. Mm. And so there's a lot of ways in which right now I see the organizing, you know, with groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace and Na'amod here in the UK, that we are all very much like working in a lineage that already exists. And also, as I was just saying before, like actually living out values that many of us were raised in, whether it's, you know, a tradition of critical inquiry and open debate. You know, the reason that there are so many young Jews fighting for Palestinian freedom is because we read the news and we see the horrors that are being committed against Palestinians, and we're asking questions about the mythologies that we were raised with, and also just like asking questions, you know, in the same way that other young people around the world are asking. This is just like, but doing so out of like coming from having been raised to ask questions, to want to learn, to want to seek, you know, deeper meanings and answers. And also, you know, for many of us, it's also because of the Holocaust education that we were raised with, learning about our own community's history of, you know, dehumanization and discrimination and violence and displacement. And we see echoes of things that we have been taught to oppose our entire lives happening in Gaza right now. It doesn't have to be exactly the same. It doesn't have to be direct comparisons. We can still know dehumanization when we see it. We can oppose state violence when we see it being committed on our phone screens every day. And those things for me are deeply Jewish values.
One of the really powerful things that this film does well, and part of it, you know, through your own voice and your own journey, is that it explains the relationship that a lot of young Jews have with Israel, a lot of young Jewish Americans have with Israel, and that growing up there is an intricable link that you feel with the state of Israel, and you feel like you are a part of this project. What does that feel like when you're a young Jewish American being taught about what Israel is and why you should believe in this project?
Yeah, I mean, we're taught to see it as a home away from home, as a safe haven that we can always go to if something, you know, goes wrong. We're taught to, you know, many of us grow up in communities where Jews are a minority. And, you know, going to a place in which, you know, your religious symbols and traditions are visible and public, and where they are the hegemony, that's something that, you know, is very meaningful for a young person to get to see and connect with. Of course, as soon as you begin to learn what the cost is, right, of the engineering of that space, to have Jewishness be in a supremacist role, and that has all been created at the expense of another society and is maintained by keeping Palestinians, by dispossessing Palestinians, expelling them, dehumanizing them, erasing them from that physical space and from the narrative of that space. It's obviously something that very quickly shatters the worldview that we were raised with. But yeah, you know, it's a really nice story to be raised with the idea that your people have been persecuted for thousands of years. And now there's this redemption story that, you know, after being persecuted for all this time, you can have this safe haven and you can have this heroic ending story where, you know, your people have triumphed over history. But of course, no history is that simple and easy. And in a lot of ways, I see the kind of like undoing of the indoctrination that, you know, I've had to go through and that many young Jews of my generation have had to go through. It's something that like people all over the world, you know, have to face about the horrible histories in their own countries and simplistic narratives that they might have been raised with that actually ignore and erase deep injustice and oppression.
what you mentioned about growing up in a minority in a society, in a larger society, I think is really rings true to me as somebody who grew up as a Muslim in the West, you know, Western society. There is something about growing up in a small community that is often, you know, becomes very tight-knit and very kind of closed off to sometimes, you know, internal criticism.
Yeah.
I can imagine it becomes very difficult to try and challenge the assumptions, the beliefs that exist in these communities that are often, you know, people become very protective over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for Jewish communities around the world, especially in places where they are smaller and people do feel the threats of anti-Semitism in their own communities, the, you know, this idea of like airing our dirty laundry mm-hmm. in public is something that feels very, very threatening to mm-hmm. people. And I really understand that. That's why I think it's so important that we disentangle the fight against anti-Semitism from criticism of Israel mm-hmm. and the idea that the, you know, only and best way to keep Jewish communities safe is to deepen pro-Israel politics mm-hmm. is so deeply dangerous. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing, you know, I mean, we talk about this a bit in the film, but just this idea that basically so many of the leading organizations that have been, you know, self-appointed guardians of our communities, mm-hmm. the ones who kind of claim the fight against anti-Semitism, who spend most of their resources on persecuting Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activists, including left-wing Jews, mm-hmm. actually further endangers our communities.
And you're one of those people that have kind of been at the receiving end of some of that negative attention, negative scrutiny. There are profiles of you on certain, you know, pro-Israeli websites that are accusing you of, you know, spreading hatred against Israel.
Yeah.
That's a lot to be able to take.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly painful to like continuously be doing this work as a deeply engaged and committed Jewish person with, you know, hundreds and thousands of other Jews who are also doing this because we love our community. We love ourselves. You know, they often call us self-hating Jews. So it's always important to also say, like, you know, I love myself as a Jewish person. Mm. And, you know, we're doing it again, like out of that deep commitment, out of a deep commitment to our own traditions and to a vision of a different future for our community. Mm. And I really think that right now, as these horrors are underway in Gaza, many of these groups have just like taken it a step too far. Mm. And we're seeing right now, you know, attacking some of the leading scholars of anti-Semitism and Jewish history and trying to keep them out of, you know, university task forces and, you know, smear campaigns against anybody who just doesn't toe this really hardline pro-Israel position. And I mean, what could be more dangerous to Jewish people right now mm-hmm. than lumping us all in with this genocidal campaign of the Israeli government? I mean, I hear all the time from people who see the film who are just so moved and so grateful to like know that there are so many of us, so many Jewish people who are speaking out against these horrors. I mean, at every major protest for a ceasefire around the world, in cities where there are Jewish people, there are going to be Jews at those rallies. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Jews turning out in record numbers as part of the ceasefire movement. And I also see that as fighting anti-Semitism because it's publicly breaking this conflation between our community and the policies of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. That if anything right now, we need more of that. We need people to understand that this is not being committed in the name of all Jews.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about that being part of a community that also has a high level of visibility, whether, you know, religiously or otherwise or politically, and taking part in these rallies. And there, you're right, there has been such a large number of young Jewish activists, young Jewish people, Jewish people of all ages that have been taking part very intentionally in a lot of these actions. There's been actions in the United States, in Congress, in, you know, in this Grand Central Station in New York, where a lot of it is framed around the idea of, you know, these are young Jewish Americans, and these are actions being led by young Jewish voices. Why is it so important for that visibility to be there, and especially at this time?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's like a continuation of what I was just saying, but I really do think that this, you know, of course, like first and foremost, the people who are most harmed by this campaign in Gaza are the Palestinian people. I mean, Israel is decimating the Gaza Strip right now beyond anything that even I could have imagined that I would ever see, even knowing the cruelty of the apartheid regime. We're in a new moment right now. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it every single day, saying they're doing this so that Jewish people in Israel and around the world can be safe. What could be more dangerous to Jewish people around the world than being associated with this genocidal campaign? I mean, I do not believe that killing almost 40,000 people now, displacing 2 million people, like in what world does that make me safer as a Jewish person? In what world is anybody safer when a government can commit such heinous crimes with such impunity? And the idea, I mean, we're already seeing it, like that this campaign is fueling not just anti-Semitism, but Islamophobia, right, and anti-Arab sentiment all around the world. And Jewish people and Muslims and Arabs around the world who have nothing to do with this are becoming very visible targets for people who already hate our communities, who already maybe, you know, want to inflame tensions against us or who want to commit violence against us. But now they have a so-called excuse and they're using it. And so I feel very afraid for Jews around the world who are receiving the public blowback from being associated with this campaign. And so I see speaking out against the Israeli government and being a visible Jew in this movement as also part of a way to keep my own community safe. Mm-hmm. And to say that, you know, not all of us are, we are not allowing ourselves to be conscripted into this. We want a world where perpetrators of war crimes are held accountable. We want a world in which all people can live safely in their homes. And that is both because of the lessons that we've taken from our own history and because of the world that we are fighting for today, that we want for all people, not just for Jews.
Mm. October 7th was, I mean, obviously an incredibly traumatic event, not just for Israeli Jews, but for Jews around the world. And you saw in the aftermath of that, a lot of people use it as a way to reaffirm their commitment to Israel, their commitment to Zionism. And there's a part of that that is, I mean, it's easy to sympathize with, right? There's a sort of level of protectionism that people want to be able to exert on their lives and the world around them. But you mentioned that you know, there are people that have taken that too far. And I wonder what the conversations that people like you and others have, not on the front lines of in the pickets, but at home or in your communities, among your friends, among people that aren't on the same political journey as you are, who are also responding to everything that's been happening and everything that happened on October 7th. What are those conversations like?
Yeah. Well, I guess this is why I also feel that, like, so humbled that Israelism has actually been a tool for people in this moment, because I think part of what is so important to me about the film is that it offers people kind of like, it offers context to this moment, right? And it offers a conceptual bridge to help people understand what is the narrative I know about Israel and what is the reality of Israel that I'm not seeing. Right. I mean, I have this line in the film, you know, what is so horrible that they can't bear to let me see it? Mm. I mean, right now, right? I mean, we are just seeing horrors upon horrors that still people in my community can't bear to look at head on. And, you know, we've seen in so many, we saw this in the U.S. I'm pretty sure this has been the case here as well. Just this idea that we can't talk about a context that existed before October 7th. And, there's so many pieces of context that I want to talk about, but I'm just thinking about, you know, the fact that, like, for the last year, or I should say, I guess, for all of 2023, right, you had Israel's most extremist right-wing government in history, which is saying a lot because many of the governments before had also been considered, you know, the most extreme right-wing governments. This was an openly fascist government, many proud, racist, homophobic, nationalist members of Knesset who were openly calling for mass expulsion of Palestinians, some even overtly genocidal in their rhetoric, and they were acting on those commitments, right? They were already, every single day in 2023, we saw someone shot in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. We saw the pogrom in Hawara last February. We saw that the pogrom in Hawara, where settlers, you know, hundreds of settlers rampaged through a Palestinian village and the army just kind of stood by and let it happen. And at the same time, we saw these, you know, Save Israeli Democracy protests where hundreds of thousands of people were in the streets and not saying anything about Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I heard from friends and colleagues, from Palestinians who were watching these protests happening and saying, where am I in this movement? Where are my rights and my well-being and like, where are they accounting for me at all within this movement? And so I think, you know, knowing how fragile and tense and desperate things were already feeling on the ground, this deep sense of despair at the deepening of Israeli apartheid and the foreclosing of options for a path for Palestinian freedom, I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking what the consequences of that have been. But that is the context that we have to understand for taking into consideration this moment. And I mean, I have a lot of, I that was a very long way of getting to your question about what are the conversations I've been having. But I mean, I have friends who just are like, you know, I was conveniently looking away from what is happening before now. And I just can't, like, you know, they're having to do a lot of quick education right now about understanding, like, what was going on the ground. How is it that, you know, you have a society in Israel that lives next door on top of, you know, next door to millions of people who are denied basic freedom and dignity and live under such extreme oppression?
Are those conversations, do you feel like they are coming naturally? Are a lot of people that you know starting to have those conversations on their own, or are you also finding people that are still shutting themselves off to them?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think obviously, look, every, like, this is, once again, this is not, you know, a unique Jewish experience, right? This is like a very human question about when you're faced with something that doesn't comport with your worldview, that makes you uncomfortable, that challenges the beliefs you might have about yourself or about your community. Do you double down? Do you close, you know, do you shut out the rest of the world and double down in the worldview that you already have? Or do you ask hard questions? Do you allow yourself to admit, like, something doesn't sit right with me? I feel heartbroken right now. I feel outraged. I feel ashamed. And, you know, do you allow those very painful and vulnerable experiences to take you somewhere where you might be transformed? And I think a lot of people, you know, I don't want to make generalizing statements, but I think we're watching both of those experiences happening right now, right? You see a lot of people who are doubling down in the denialism, who are doing everything they can to tune out what's happening in Gaza, to dig even more deeply in their own, you know, feelings of grievance grievance and fear and victimhood. And then you have a lot of people who are like, you know, this is not what I signed up for. This is not what I believe in and can stand for. And I see so many people who are having those really painful, intimate conversations in their own families, and with loved ones who are, you know, coming to protest for the first time in their lives, who are, you know, reading books and uncovering the history that's been shielded from us our entire lives. And it's a real moment of transformation for a lot of people.
Mm. Do you feel like there's a generational shift happening in the US right now?
I just think it's undeniable that, like, the experience of being a young person who on social media right now, you almost have to work quite hard to not know what's going on in Gaza right now, because the genocide is being live streamed onto our phones. I mean, we are seeing young people who you know, look like us, have the same, you know, hopes and aspirations as we do, who want to just live a normal life, to be safe and free. You know, these amazing, like, storytellers and content creators. I'm just thinking about, like, Bisan, who, you know, I mean, was making these beautiful storytelling videos, and now it's continuing to make beautiful storytelling videos, but they're, like, from tents with displaced people, you know, and, like, reporting on the horrific destruction happening all around them every single day. I mean, the end, at this point, it's almost like cliche. It's not cliche. Like, we should all be retelling, like, the children, the families, like, the things that we are all seeing right now. You can't unsee those things. And I do think that there are many reasons that there is this generational divide. You know, young people in America tend to be much more progressive overall. You know, young Jews are just, like, we're not different than the rest of our generation in America that, like, have all these progressive values, that are part of movements for racial and economic justice, and see the fight for Palestinian freedom as deeply intertwined with these other commitments that we already have. And I also think just the experience of being in these, the way that we get information right now. I mean, you know, many of our parents do not see the horrors that we are watching on our phones every day. They don't see children, you know, like, injured children, like, shaking on hospital beds. They don't see these young people, like, where all, you know, young people who are just trying to get food for their families, who are telling these stories of just, like, the horrors that they're living through every day. And they're also not seeing the videos of young Israeli soldiers who are celebrating their war crimes and, you know, laughing and playing on the rubble of Palestinian homes in Gaza. And I think both of those experiences feel like it's, like, reality unfiltered, and it's so radicalizing to see all of that happening on our phones. And I think many people are really transformed by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is true to the way that a lot of Western societies have tended to view the conflict in Israel and Palestine, and how a younger generation of these societies is reacting. And because it's social media and access to the immediacy of what's happening on the ground, there has been a very clear gap between the way that the last 6 months have been portrayed through social media and the way that they've been portrayed through traditional media.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just to, like, put an even finer point on it, you know, like, we're raised with these messages about Israel that, like, you know, the Israeli army is the most moral army in the world. They do everything they can, you know, not to target civilians. We hear these talking points repeated even still, not targeting civilians. And we're watching on our phones civilians being massacred. We are seeing videos of soldiers celebrating their war crimes. I mean, it's like... The reality that is being, like, televised directly to us just, like, demolishes those talking points in an instant. They just don't hold up when you actually are paying attention to what's going on.
Because also, I mean, this is especially true in the U.S., I think, the space for debate around Israel has been very narrow. And you mentioned the pro-democracy movement that took place last year, and over the, you know, the judicial overhaul proposed by Netanyahu and his government, and the fears that people were voicing around the rise of, you know, the far right in Israel. And now, similarly, you are starting to see criticism of Israel seeping into those public conversations. But again, a lot of it is around, this is about Netanyahu. Yeah. If we get rid of Netanyahu and bring somebody else who's more moderate, then, you know, things will calm down and we can kind of go back to the way things are. Is that how do you see this debate and the way that it plays into people's understandings of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very desperate attempt from an older generation to contain the rage that has been unleashed, right? And to just say that, you know, if we get rid of this guy, it'll be okay. But, I mean, we've heard this genocidal incitement from across the leadership in Israeli society. We see the polling numbers. We know that there's actually broad support for this war and that it's not just the decision-making of one person. Mm-hmm. So I feel like what I can just say is that, like, for me, the message of this moment is that, like, the status quo is so fundamentally broken and the way things have been done for decades. This isn't about, you know, the catastrophe that was, you know, Israel's security failure on October 7th. It's not just about that. It's about decades of decision-making that have, you know, instituted this regime of supremacy that privileges Israeli Jews at the expense of Palestinians and that makes everyone who lives in that region less safe. And I don't feel particularly hopeful right now that, like, you know, I know that one election is not going to change that. Mm-hmm. It's something that is something that's going to be probably many decades until we get to a place where all the people who live in that land can be genuinely safe and okay. I mean, even just imagining what it's going to take to rebuild Gaza right now, mm-hmm. right? It's like kind of unfathomable how far we're going to have to go right now to get to a place of safety and well-being for all people in that land. But I don't feel like I think many of my peers, like, understand that, because we also, you know, part of what this moment is revealing is the extent to which so many of the systems that govern our world are so fundamentally broken. You know, we know in the U.S. it's not just a question of one election mm-hmm. that's going to fix this. We can see how deeply broken and compromised our whole system is.
And that's part of the work that you have been doing as well with, if not now, and some other groups, is challenging the relationship that the U.S. has politically with Israel.
Yeah.
Challenging the role that pro-Israeli groups have on the U.S. political system.
Yeah.
Where do you see that going? Where do you see that fight going for you, for others like you?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I can say two things to that just came to mind right now. You know, the first is that, you know, AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. has, you know, pledged to spend $100 million to defeat progressive members of Congress in this election, which is terrifying to anybody who cares about the fight against climate change, for economic justice, like all these other issues, racial justice. And the idea that, like, as we have this, you know, rising, right, white Christian nationalist movement in the U.S., that, like, the place that we're going to have to invest our energy is just to protect our champions mm-hmm. and keep them in the house when there are real dangers to our community. It also just, like, shows to what extent many of the kind of, like, leading pro-Israel forces, not just in the U.S., but actually around the world, have made common cause with the far right and are willing to kind of sell out any other kind of commitment to principles of safety and well-being for anyone and to put this kind of pro-Israel politics above all else. That's mm-hmm. also how we see, you know, Netanyahu making common cause with some of the leading, you know, racist authoritarian leaders around the world. Who are also, of course, like many of them, quite anti-Semitic. Mm. That's the same case in the U.S. Mm. And so, like, you know, that just highlights to what extent the fight against anti-Semitism and the fight for Jewish safety is so deeply intertwined with the fight for, you know, safety and well-being for all people, because this is not keeping Jewish people safe to have our community tied in with this far-right agenda.
Let's talk about the issue of anti-Semitism, because it is undeniably on the rise given the what is happening politically. But also, when you look at the United States,
yeah,
and going into an election season where Donald Trump is the favorite once again,
yeah,
and the spike in anti-Semitism the last time he was elected president,
yeah,
how do you have a conversation about anti-Semitism where you are able to divide between the real and imminent concerns of anti-Semitism with the accusations of anti-Semitism that are used by some people to silence voices such as yourself that want to talk about Israel?
You know, I can just say, like, some of the attacks on you know, Jews in the ceasefire movement, on the film, we've reached a moment where, like, it's just become so laughably absurd, if it weren't also just so tragic. You know, we're seeing these smears against Jewish people. I mean, against a film that is made by American Jews about Jews for a Jewish audience, to call that anti-Semitic, right? To have a film that actually tells the story of real conversations that are happening in our communities, to call that a threat to our own people is, like, it's so ridiculous and absurd and offensive. But the other thing about it is that, you know, I just think it's so... First of all, I'll just say that, like, we're seeing a kind of, like, unprecedented escalation, obviously, in this attempt to kind of cancel pro-Palestinian voices, to smear people, to get people fired from their jobs, to have events canceled, all under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. First of all, I can say in the U.S. that we're seeing, just to connect to the point I was making before, we're seeing how that attempt has found a very deep partnership with this broader far-right movement that wants to, you know, ban the teaching of critical race theory.
Yeah, in immigration America. And
it's this far-right agenda that wants to, you know, shut down universities as a site of learning, not just because of Israel-Palestine, but because they don't want American universities to be teaching about the history of racism in our own country. And this is also something that's not just in the U.S., right? This is something happening around the world, that we're seeing the way that these pro-Israel groups are finding partners with these very authoritarian and reactionary movements. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really dangerous to Jewish people to have us be associated with these, for us to be used as cover, right, for these, like, repressive authoritarian movements. And also, you know, that Jews, you know, right now, it's also important for me to say that, like, the reason that the U.S. is so deeply supporting Israel's campaign in Gaza is actually not about Jewish safety, right? Mm-hmm. It's about U.S. imperial interests in the region. It's about, you know, the interests of weapons companies. It's about the Christian Zionist lobby in America that has their own, which is actually the largest pro-Israel lobby in America, yeah, right? Which has their own interests in supporting a, you know, very right-wing, Islamophobic, nationalist foreign policy. And none of those things are actually about Jews and about keeping Jews safe. But once again, when we are used as the cover for those things, that fuels anti-Semitism. Mm. And I think in this moment in which people are feeling such a deep hopelessness about the possibility of getting accountability from our governments. I mean, the fact that you have, you know, majorities in this country, in the U.S., that support a ceasefire, and the fact that our politicians aren't willing to do anything about it and aren't listening, it does give fuel to people who then start to wonder, why is it that our governments aren't listening to people? Maybe there's some other nefarious group that's controlling the government behind the scenes that, you know, is the real, and that fuels anti-Semitism and that endangers Jews.
Because you don't want to have those conversations. You don't want to keep refuting conspiracy theories about Jews that are fueling this rise in anti-Semitism, right. But you also want to engage in a real conversation about what is and isn't legitimate critique of Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, this environment that fuels conspiratorial thinking is one in which is very dangerous for Jews. And also this environment in which Jews, but also non-Jews, are constantly using the smear of anti-Semitism to shut down criticism of pro-Palestinian voices and activism, it then makes people doubt if anti-Semitism is even a real thing that we should care about, or if it's just another one of these smears, or the smear that is being used to shut down the public space.
And what is the consequence of this being a reality? You know, getting to a point where people are no longer taking the accusation of anti-Semitism seriously.
Yeah, again, I think that the consequence is making it harder for people to actually understand anti-Semitism, to want to take it seriously. And it makes more people confused about where anti-Semitism is actually real. And, you know, so much of the work that we do on the Jewish left is having to disentangle these things, right? To be teaching people about the real history of anti-Semitism, to understand the places in which anti-Semitism can continue to crop up in our movements and in our societies, and bending over backwards to distinguish that from critique of the Israeli government and opposition to this campaign in Gaza.
You've mentioned some of the attacks and the negative reactions to the film since it's come out. Tell me about the positive reactions. Tell me what else people have been telling you.
Yeah, well, the one thing I'll just say about the negative reactions is they're almost entirely from people who don't watch the film.
Yeah.
So that also kind of proves the point, right? That they don't actually want to engage in the conversation. It's been really amazing to have people around the world, you know, reaching out, Jewish people first and foremost, who are, you know, thanking us for telling their stories, who are, you know, using the film as a tool to have these painful conversations in their families for the first time. I've had many people say to me that this has been the one way that they've been able to have a meaningful conversation with, you know, a loved one. That in this time in which things are so emotional and fraught, it's been an entry point for them. So in some ways, that's my favorite thing to hear. And I will say the other thing that I've been getting a lot, which is really powerful and meaningful, and it also connects to this conversation about anti-Semitism, is that I've heard from tons of people who aren't Jewish from around the world who are really grateful to hear a different narrative than what they, you know, usually see in the media about Jews, and to understand how these debates are happening in our community, and who are so moved by the presence of Jews in this movement right now, and appreciate that it's not easy for those of us who come from communities where this stuff is still so painful, and yet it's also important for me to say, it feels the absolute least thing that we can do right now, when, you know, the state of Israel is acting in my name and massacring tens of thousands of people. It feels, the bare minimum.
So one of the things that the film does really well is that it kind of presents almost a very sympathetic lens on what it means to grow up in the communities that you've grown up in, and why you have this relationship with Israel and what it means on a very personal level.
Yeah.
So I was watching the film with a couple of friends, and we paused it after 15 minutes, and we were just kind of joking that the film was so convincing in its argument for Zionism in the first 15 minutes of the film, that if you just turn it off there, you could go away and be like, all right, I get it. Yeah, I'm pro-Israeli now. And that was refreshing, but it was also surprising because I didn't expect that going in, but it ends up being such an important part of the story of how the film presents voices such as yours.
Yeah.
Why is that aspect of it important, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things I want to say about that. I think, you know, like, there is a real reason that Zionism resonated so deeply for so many Jews. You know, it wasn't the majority position. Like, it's important to say there were always those debates. And there's also a reason that so many Jews, you know, saw the Zionist project as a genuine safe haven, right? And why after the Holocaust, the idea of, you know, having a home resonated for so many people. And it's, I guess, important. I think that we're in a moment right now in which, like, so many of the decisions that were made by imperial powers after World War II, we're seeing, right, the costs. We're seeing that international system that was set up after the Holocaust and its failures and hypocrisies, you know, turned up to 1,000. You know, the system of international law that was created ostensibly to, you know, protect all people from human rights abuses and uphold rights for all people. And we're seeing the way that, like, I mean, the Nakba happened in 1948. There's always been this exception for Palestine that was built into this world system. And we're seeing the cost of that failure that failure to consistently enforce these principles for people around the world. But I think that, you know, just on a personal level in our communities, Jews are not, you know, we are not special. I mean, you know, I was raised with a narrative that I was special. had to unlearn that too. But, you know, we are not unique. We are people who have, you know, come from histories of oppression and persecution and also benefited from many systems of privilege, especially in the United States. And I think that this, you know, this learning and unlearning process is not, there's obviously a unique experience that the Jewish communities have gone through, but it's not something that only we have to go through. I'm just, when you asked that question, it made me think about a professor that I had in college. I had to read this article my sophomore year of college about, it's this very famous interview between Benny Morris and Ari Shavit in Haaretz, where Benny Morris talks about the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians in 1948, and says, like, basically, yeah, we did it, and it was a good thing, and we had to do it. And I remember reading that interview. It's just, it's so blatant and simple. And I read it, and it was, like, so arresting to me to be like, hold on a second. Like, first of all, I didn't know about the Nakba. And also, just to hear somebody be that clear about supporting these crimes that were committed. And I remember coming to my professor who, and saying, you know, I can't believe that, you know, this happened and that this is something that people support. And I remember he said to me, you know, he was from Turkey, and he said, you know, I had to come to terms with really horrible things that happened in my country as well. And, you know, hearing that somebody else, you know, from a totally different context was also having to grapple with, like, the really dark sides of his country's history was, you know, a really important part for me in my own journey.
And I think that's a really astute point, right, that every society has a story about itself that it likes to tell itself.
Yes.
That allows it to feel like it has a special place in history. And almost no society is an exception from that.
Yeah, no. And I think it's like, you know, there's a story that Israel likes to tell itself, right, about being uniquely moral. Obviously, that story is really crumbling before our eyes right now. But it's also important to say, it's like, all people have the capacity to be victims, and all people have the capacity to be perpetrators and to commit, you know, horrible crimes. And the idea that experiencing oppression in the past exonerates you or makes you unable to do those things, you know, that's where I think we have this debate in the Jewish community, right? Is it, like, never again for us, or is it never again for anybody? Is the lesson of the Holocaust to circle the wagons and to, you know, defend only our community at the expense of all else, or is the lesson of experiencing anti-Semitism that we understand dehumanization and oppression and state violence and that we fight for that for all people, because that's the world in which we will be genuinely safe. And it's very clear to me what the lesson is of this moment. Obviously, it's still very contested, but I think that's like, yeah, I mean, in that way, it feels like a very universal message that, you know, many of us have to ask those questions in our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to end our conversation, right? That this is a fight that you are fighting in your community, but that there are other similar fights that a lot of people have to fight in their own families. And
yeah, and I'll just say like that actually another really amazing and surprising thing that's happened to me, like as I've been touring with this film, is I've had people come up to me who say, you know, I want to have a conversation in my community about this thing, totally disconnected, right, from Palestine, Israel. Like, you know, I live in a country that has committed these crimes and we can't talk about it. And this film made me think about what does it look like to have those really painful conversations in my community. So that's also just been really meaningful to like have those, to see so many people from different places, like seeing themselves in this story as well.
Are you hopeful that those conversations are becoming easier for people in your community?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I mean, I think right now we have no choice, right? I mean, I say, you know, for me, the story of the film, it's not about my own, you know, unique courage. It's about this very ordinary human experience of allowing yourself to be transformed when you're heartbroken, when you face these things that don't comport with your worldview. And, I mean, we should all like never be the same after what we've witnessed in Gaza. And so I hope, you know, it's like if there were ever a moment to like to take action, to ask yourself questions, to allow yourself to take a risk and step out, it's like it is right now. And yeah, I hope that this gives more people another like tool in their toolbox to think about how to do that.
Simone Zimmerman, it's been a real pleasure having you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This episode of The Big Picture is produced by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Thank you to Hossam Sarhan for filming and Anas Ala for graphics. And thanks to you for listening. If this episode struck a chord with you, or if you disagreed with what was said, we want to hear from you. So you can reach me on Twitter at Mohammed Was Here or by email at mh@middleeasteye.org. You can also watch all of our episodes in video format on our YouTube channel. If you like this, please consider giving us a rating because it goes a long way and helps us reach new audiences. Until next time, salam.